Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of my podcast, my interview series. Major apologies right off the bat. My voice is clearly a little bit tanked, and I have the sniffles because I have allergies, so just ignore that. Maybe it sounds good. Maybe the audio sounds better. Who knows? Maybe this is my next evolution as a person, but I do want to let you know that today's episode is incredibly fascinating. I feel so privileged to have had this conversation. I figured after having a conversation with someone in Ukraine, I wanted to also have a conversation with someone in Russia to gain a greater perspective of not both sides, as in like I'm trying to figure out who to side with, but more so on the cultural oppression within Russia, what it's like to be under a dictatorship, what it's like to be within the censorship and not be able to protest. So I found someone who was willing to have that conversation with me to give a little bit of perspective of what it's like to live in Russia. She grew up there. She doesn't live there anymore, so she's not necessarily in any sort of trouble if she tells me these things. But because it is such a scary thing to do, to talk out or to speak out against Russia in some type of way, I am going to be blurring her face. We did use a different name, and there's a good chance I'm also going to distort her audio as well, because I do not want her to be in any way in fear for her life or the life of her friends or family. It's a very real thing, so please do respect that and know that the conversation is deeply important, and I, again, think everybody should listen to it. So as I usually say, be kind, be respectful, be gracious. You know, this is a perspective. I think it's a deeply important perspective to have. I think one of the best things you can get out of life is perspective. So just know that going into this. But anyways, I hope that you enjoy this conversation I had with Nastya.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Cool deal. Can you give me a clap just to make sure? Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back. Today, I'm here with another lovely guest and another very fascinating story. Can you do me a favor and introduce yourself to the audience with your pronouns, a little bit about your background?
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Nastya, and my pronouns are she, her. And I was born in the late 80s in then Soviet Union, now Russia, and immigrated with my family to the U.S. when I was 11 years old in the 90s, end of 1990s, so after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so I completed my primary school education in Russia and then high school, college in the U.S. And a doctorate in the U.S. that I finished last year.
Amazing. I feel like when I was looking for someone to talk to about this, I was looking for someone very particular. I wanted it to be someone who was educated on it, but also separate from it and safe from it. And you just really felt like the right person to tell me what it's like growing up in Russia, a little bit of a perspective of I guess, like life in Russia, as well as what it would be like to be living in Russia during this war. As you know, as I've heard from a lot of people in my direct messages who live in Russia, they've been saying, people don't understand. Most people don't want this war here, but no one's listening to us. They're painting us as the villains. So I wanted to hop on here and I guess just bring light to that of you know, kind of those untold stories. So could you do me a favor and just tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Russia, you know, your childhood, the culture, everything?
Sure. Yeah. So I was 5 years old when the Soviet Union collapsed, and my sense of Russian culture was very influenced by that event. I didn't really grow up in communism anymore, but it was sort of the aftermath of a state that was fleeting, a state that was no longer functioning. But people were still trying to live by values of, you know, what they knew and how they were raised in the Soviet Union. And some of those values, one can say, are not that different from what I experienced later in the U.S., and some of them are dramatically different. So it's definitely, you know, it was definitely in my childhood much more collective living. But because it was already after, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was no longer the state infrastructure that would provide, for example, free access to healthcare, free access to education, kind of the kind of community organizing that would be demanded and expected by the state. So I only witnessed fragments and snippets of what once was. But at the state that I witnessed it as a child, it was already pretty dysfunctional.
Okay.
Because, of course, what happened in 1991 when Soviet Union collapsed is everything was privatized almost overnight. So you can imagine, you know, like a big industry or a big factory that was state-owned and it had a big hierarchy of directors and managers and workers and so on. So overnight, a simple way to think about it is the directors became owners and everybody else became shareholders in that industry. It was one of the ways in which corruption, you know, really, it didn't originate because corruption already existed in the Soviet Union, but it was one of the ways in which corruption became monetized. Because, of course, those directors were the people that then became oligarchs. They're the people that, in many cases, wanted to just sell the industry and have the money for themselves for other things, putting millions of people out of work and closing many industries on which the state prior to that was reliant and on which much of the population was trained. So that was sort of, obviously as a child, I didn't understand everything that was happening, but I witnessed a lot of crime and I witnessed a lot of havoc. And, you know, some places in mid-90s in Russia were very much like a civil war. There were people who were losing jobs, who also had no kind of perspective as to where they're going because they had just lost a kind of paternalistic state that told them what their values are and told them what they should live by. And now not only did that state disappear, but there wasn't really a sensible replacement. And so the time that that we left with my family was probably, you know, some of the hardest years for Russia in those few decades. And yeah, and that included, you know, not only crime, but economic hardship and kind of covering of basic needs and so on.
I mean, that sounds like when you think about growing up, what feelings come to mind, not to go full therapist on you, but that sounds difficult and it sounds stressful, frankly. Did it feel that way or was it the rose colored glasses of not fully understanding, but or not really even understanding that the rest of the world was, or not the rest, but like some parts of the world were dissimilar to that?
I mean, I think, you know, one understands everything relatively. And so as a child, I didn't know anything else. I know that when we came to the US and I had somewhat of an illusion as well, but the sense of, okay, now I'm safe. Like, I remember that very vividly. And of course, you know, we immigrated to not the greatest neighborhood in Chicago where there was a lot of gun violence in public schools. So just to sort of say that, you know, what I watched on TV and what I thought United States was, it was not actually congruent with reality. But but yeah, it was a difficult time and I think it's a time that people remember still. And it is a time that, you know, wasn't that long ago. It was a time that it's kind of colloquially called as the brain drain. You know, a lot of people left that were just, you couldn't really, as a cultural worker, as an academic, as a highly trained professional, like you just couldn't really live and survive. The only way to live and survive in that time was to engage in market economy. And the market economy was very new and nobody really knew what they're doing. Like all of those shareholders and industries, they, for example, like people in my family were given shares in industries they worked, but their education told them that previous education told them that engaging in market economy is a bad thing. Like it's not a desirable thing to do. So people, they hid these vouchers under their pillows, and that's one way to crash an economy. And so that sort of happened over and over again. And again, as a child, I didn't understand the mechanics of what was happening, but I was witness to the results of it and to, sort of utter chaos. And so my family were actually, we were refugees when we came. And
that's what I was going to ask, if you could tell me the specific reason why you left.
Yeah, so I mean, some of it was economic hardship. Some of it was religious persecution. My mother's side of the family was Jewish, is Jewish. And it was the kind of anti-Semitism that my family experienced was never so extreme in the times of the Soviet Union. And that's quite specific to my hometown and my family. Like there were definitely hometowns or towns in Russia where that was otherwise. Mm-hmm. But I think the anti-Semitism really became a problem after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because my grandfather, who owned a business, who had some kinds of assets that the sort of new local infrastructure wanted to have, the new local corrupt infrastructure that was emerging, and quite a crime-ridden infrastructure, wanted a piece of. And when my grandfather was in disagreement, there were all sorts of threats, and essentially was unsafe for. And the threats were not directed at him, but in the clever way, of course, at his family. And so it was no longer safe to be there. But I think I'd reiterate that even the Jewish aspect aside, it would have been equally unsafe if he was just, a person that didn't want to collaborate, quote unquote, or cooperate with the forming dynamic, corrupt regime of the time.
It's interesting because, I mean, like you said, it's not that long ago. I mean, it's easy to feel like the 90s were so far in the past, but it's, it's both of our, it's like my existence. I was born in 92. So it's just fascinating when people kind of separate it as like so far in the past, something that's completely dissimilar now. Do you think that Russia has, it's such a vague question, but do you think that things have changed since then in Russia, or is it in a weird way stuck in that period, that like turbulent confusion period ever since the 90s?
It's a good question. It's a hard question. Mm-hmm. I think, and there's no single answer. I think the way history works is when it's traumatic, there's a kind of response to it, which is almost a one of amnesia, of historical amnesia. People want to forget it, and they want to close their eyes not only on certain events that happened, but their consequences in order to live in joy in their dailiness, to have the ability to live in joy. So there's some of that. But of course, also the way history works is you can't erase it. It doesn't go away. Like trauma is trauma. And until one deals with it, one being a person, a state, a geopolitical infrastructure, until it is dealt with, it will keep resurfacing one way or another. And so while I think, and you can observe this, I have observed this in recent trips to Russia, I've observed both. I have observed much historical amnesia. I've also observed much resurfacing of the trauma. And what's more is I think Russia has a lot of those instances prior to the 90s. In World War II, a third of the male population was essentially killed or lost. It was a tragic, traumatic event that, I grew up 40 years, 50 years after the end of the war, but I heard about it constantly and it felt like something extremely present. And then you go back and there's First World War and there's the revolution that led to the formation of the Soviet Union, which held its own set of traumas that were very quickly suppressed when the Stalinist regime was established. And so I think Russia has an extraordinary amount of these really heavy events, actually not that far apart, if you think on kind of a historical timeline. And you have generation after generation, this dance, this game between between amnesia and resurfacing. And unfortunately, I don't think the state, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, has really taken measures to deal with it and to address it in a healthy way. And so you can expect then individual or select group attempts to do so, each in their own way. But as we see now, when it go or counteracts the main ambition of the state, it is very quickly suppressed.
Which is kind of a great segue into, because of course, I mean, this isn't an interview. Like, when I proposed the question on Instagram, I had a lot of people being like, why would you want to talk to somebody in Russia? Why aren't you focusing only on Ukraine? And I'm like, that's such a simple way of looking at something. It's not about me focusing on Russia because I think some, they're right, or that I'm trying to prove someone's right or wrong. It's about, clearly it's a conflict between two parties. So to understand it as a whole, you have to understand the individual parts. And I feel like a lot of what you're explaining is already explaining how we kind of got here. But I would, I guess for the, not really a historical sense, but I would love to know kind of what do you think people in Russia right now are feeling about this war, and kind of what do you think they're going through in terms of, like, with the propaganda and the censorship, and the inability to really speak up and speak out freely? How do you think it's affecting those people, the people that don't want this but are clearly being affected?
Yeah,
it's a long question.
Yeah, no, I think I might actually or say a couple of words to the first part of your comment, that this is a war between two parties, and it's extremely easy to look at any question or any proposition as black and white, X versus Y, zero or one, in a very binary, dualistic way. It's much easier to do. And
definitely,
most of the time, it's when it comes to anything that has to do with human lives, it's the wrong thing to do.
Totally.
And to even backtrack a little bit, I think in some way, just given the recent history of the pandemic, of Black Lives Matter movements, of various protests and uprisings around the world, English-speaking, educated, young audience who's on social media is conditioned to sort of be for or against something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's understandable. It's also very unfortunate, because any conflict has not only a historical dimension to, like, what is Russia and what is Ukraine, but Russia and Ukraine don't exist in isolation. There are many other powers, other countries, other, economic infrastructures that exist around both of those powers that are inevitably engaged. And so it's as difficult as that is, the sort of temptation to be like, ah, I can't believe you're doing this and not that, is worth practicing, because when one, takes a step back and just tries to understand that, Russia, who is Russia? Like,
yes,
when we
yes.
say Russia, what do we mean? Mm-hmm. There are the people of Russia who didn't elect Putin. There's Putin. There's the circle of Putin. There's the circle around the circle of Putin, who may or may not be safe, may or may not agree, may or may not be proponents of, and it's such a multidimensional, complex beast that terming Russia and claiming that we know who that even is kind of absurd. So mm-hmm. that's just a spiel on non-binarism.
I fully agree. I think people need to think more complexly about that. So thank you for laying that out.
And then on censorship, I think it's, again, not so new. There has been, in the last few years in Russia, growing censorship. So it was last year that, for example, that there was a decree saying that too many news media or cultural organizations are funded by money from the West.
Mm.
And there was a decree saying that that's not welcome, and that if your organization receives any donations from the so-called West, however small, you are obliged to begin any article, for example, that you publish with big capital letters, or any YouTube video that you make with a disclaimer in capital letters saying that this information is presented by a foreign agent.
Wow.
And that sounds kind of absurd, but it's real. You know, there are several newspapers, all of which can no longer work in Russia under present circumstances. And if you just go onto their YouTube channel and you click on any video, the video begins with giant block letters saying the information presented is brought to you by a foreign agent.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that.
And so, it's on Wikipedia. This isn't, you know, it's not secret information. It's just, yeah. I think, so absurd that it's almost unbelievable, but it's true. And so if you are somebody who's living in Russia and has been, you know, watching Russian state media and has already been receiving information that, you know, foreign news are bad, you can imagine then, like, this added layer just making it psychologically that much more obvious to you that mm-hmm. you shouldn't listen to this other media. You know, they're clearly in the wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. They're faking all of the material that they're presenting to you. Again, it's having a radar for binarism.
Yep. Yeah, it adds a layer of doubt.
Yeah, and when people are kind of trained over and over to think in a binary way and to think in a black and white way, a move like that will not only censor certain things, but will prevent people from engaging with media outside of the state media. So that didn't directly answer your question. That's sort of the other side. On censorship, now, as I said, the sort of most, I'd say, or least controlled by the state media are no longer allowed to work in Russia. Their offices have been closed. So some of them are still putting stuff up through YouTube, but otherwise, they don't have an agency. Their agency has been dissolved. In terms of, you know, how easy it is, for example, to go outside in a protest, it's growing impossible. So shortly after the start of the war, there was a decree put out that said that you are not allowed to call the special operation in Ukraine a war. It is not a war, it is a special operation. And if you call it a war, you are subject to receiving 15 years in prison, almost automatically. So it's been actually, again, absurd and sad and depressing at the same time to see people's reactions, because no war in Russian is «нет войне», like no to war. And so people started coming out with, a sign that doesn't say no war. It just has three asterisks for the word «нет» and then five asterisks for the word war. And they get detained for that. They will come out with a sign that says two words and they get detained for that. They come out with a blank sign and they still get detained for that.
That's
so
terrifying.
It's, you know, it's kind of to the point of absurdity that I think people are trying to test the limits and see, okay, like, if I come out, you know, in the middle of Red Square and just stand there, like, what can
Loiter.
I put my hand up? Like, what can I do? You know? And I think what's becoming more clear is even the decree that says, you know, you can't call it a war. That's all a placeholder for you can't gather in public spaces in a way that isn't controlled by the state. And you cannot make public displays of your collective opinion about anything that's not controlled by the state. And sadly, that's also transferring to social media. So there's news that Instagram will be blocked, or at least partially blocked, and sort of other non-Russian social media may be impacted. There is a lot of precedent in Russia of people cleverly foregoing that. So one of the most widespread tools that people use to communicate is Telegram.
Interesting.
If you don't know, it's kind of like WhatsApp, but it's I guess it's not owned by Facebook, which people like. It has a precedent of not giving encryption keys over, not handing over encryption keys to the government during protests. And that precedent happened in Russia as well as in other places. Telegram, you know, it can hold channels of like many people and share information and be fairly secure, relatively secure. So since Telegram at some point refused to hand over encryption keys to the government, this was a few years ago, on Telegram's, Russian government banned Telegram, but Telegram developed all sorts of bots to basically forego the banning. And if you were in Russia, you'd have to sort of install some new bot once a month or once every couple of weeks or then once every few months. But anyway, I envision something like this will continue to happen where people, you know, continue to, with like a blank paper and also in the virtual space, continue to try to push against or figure out what the boundaries are. But I do worry that today, as opposed to 5 years ago, those boundaries are so more extreme, authoritarian and militaristic that the reality will just be that many more people will end up imprisoned.
It's genuinely hard to imagine that growing up in, you know, such a free country as America, that I don't think, when I think people are saying that, of like, why aren't they just protesting? They don't fully understand that level of oppression and fear tactics of, you know, saying you may go to jail for 15 years. Maybe you won't. Who knows? Maybe you will. But just saying it and knowing the history of Putin and of the current administration, you know, the fear element of it alone would keep, I don't know if I would have the strength to protest something like that if I was in Russia and I was against war, like it sounds like a lot of people are. Do you know if people are, you know, going to prison for long lengths of time like that? I'm sure they are, but sometimes I think people don't believe it. They're like, no, they could never just put all, I think it was 7,500 people were already put in jail within the first like week of this. Is there any way to really know that, I guess?
I mean, many of them will get released. Many of them will get abused, even if they're for 2 weeks. If you followed any of the protests happening in Belarus last year, the tactic is very similar. I mean, the tactic is ultimately to prevent people from going out and doing it again. And you don't need to imprison all of them. You just have to make them so terrified that they don't do it again. And I think also many people have left and are trying to leave. So people especially who have been active and who have been activists and who have been speaking against the Putin regime, they, in various ways, they have gotten the memo that it is not safe for them to remain in Russia. And for some, it's easier to leave than others. But for example, if you're a journalist working for one of those media organizations that is now closed, there's a very good chance that you might be accused of something you said even 2 years ago. So it doesn't really matter what you say now. If at some point, you know, the kind of thing that you published needs to really be erased and you need to be given kind of, you just need to be, your history needs to be erased. It may or may not be a wise thing for you to remain. But, you know, one thing that's a problem is it's not easy for people to know where to go. Because, you know, if you are a Ukrainian citizen right now, you can essentially show up at any border of any European country and you are given a refugee status, which in different countries in different ways, but also comes with some humanitarian aid and support. If you're a Russian person who is, you know, you're not being bombed. It is not the same thing. You're not running from a war zone in the same way. But it is legitimately not safe for you to stay in Russia. Because of the sanctions, because the airspace is closed, there are really only three countries you can fly to. You can fly to, well, you can fly to Armenia, you can fly to Turkey, you can fly to Serbia. And that's not on Russian Airlines, who presently cannot fly anywhere else. And from there, you are not given asylum. You are not a refugee. You're just showing up. And because so many people are leaving, also those local communities are getting inundated with Russians coming, and they are not necessarily welcoming it. And so there's also rising, not only are they not welcoming people coming, but of course, kind of like the people maybe on your channel making those comments, people on the ground are also like, we hate Russians, we support Ukrainians. So, you know, as like a Russian activist who may have been on the streets for the last 5 years, maybe have been imprisoned, maybe have, you know, really tried to make an effort to do something, you show up, for example, in Tbilisi in Georgia right now, and you have this big lash of Russophobia. And, you know, I have friends who are having a hard time just renting an apartment because people don't want to rent to Russians. Wow. And so it's that, again, that dualism and that lack of complexity and that lack of being, having the time and being able to look at a person's individual kind of track record and, you know, yeah. what is it that they have been trying to do, that I think is going to continue to make this a really big problem for Russian people moving forward, because regardless of how the war develops, and whichever way it develops, it will not be pretty. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, times will somehow quickly change in order for Russians to be painted in a pink fuzzy light. So the Russian people will unfortunately continue to be the scapegoat for Putin's actions. And that will be felt not only in Russia, but everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's really tragic.
It really is. I mean, I immediately started feeling, because I thought I was looking up even just like the populations, just to like get a, I'm so bad with geography, I'm so bad with history and everything. But I was looking up, I was like, okay, 44 million people in Ukraine, 144 million people in Russia. And then when all the sanctions were placed and all the businesses were pulling out of Russia, concerts canceled, flights canceled, everything, I just started being like, that's over 100 million, 140, you know, 4 million people that are now in absolute chaos. And it sounds like a vast majority of them want nothing to do with this, want absolutely nothing to do with this. And I immediately was overcome with so much empathy for those people, as well as like just sadness that it doesn't seem like Putin cares one bit about that. It seems like he's gone rogue and doesn't care about the potential long-term effects of what this might do to those people's lives. So and this is really jumping ahead in our questions, but what do you think will happen no matter what? I don't think they're at this point, with how many things have gone wrong and how many disadvantages have been put on Russia, sanctions, etc. It seems like even if they quote unquote win, they lose. What do you think about that? Like what?
So, oof, there's a lot in there.
I know. I'm sorry. Sometimes I'm like, oh, so many things.
No, that's fine. I think so. Maybe to the previous conversation, one thing I think it's important to add is it's not the case that every person in Russia is against the war. Mm-hmm. It is the case that there are some people, just like, you know, there were people supporting rather extremist rhetoric in the United States a few months ago and a couple of years ago. There are people who are endorsing Putin. And one way, so the first thing to say about that is, what's the percentage? That's really hard to know. That's really hard to gauge on any sensible level, because everything's so monitored. By that, I mean, like, people are no longer feel safe expressing things, even on Facebook. I know people who have taken down all record on their social media of ever having been in a protest. So, and it's a matter of safety, right? But the reason, like what we started with in the history of the 90s and the crime and the turmoil is, there are people, older people, older generation people, who also remember Putin as somebody who came and quote unquote made order during a time of complete chaos, complete disarray, following the 90s and the decade after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so it's not like, you know, state-controlled media doesn't brainwash people overnight. It's been in the making. But part of the reason people were susceptible to that, and part of the reason Putin was welcomed by a big part of the population that was like, oh, wow, okay, I'm not afraid to have my child walk alone to school anymore in the way that I was 10 years ago. Mm. And that's worth also understanding and empathizing with. None of that validates war. None of it. None of it validates the current regime. But those people are also human. And they have a human psychology, and that psychology has a memory of a trauma, and what they want to prevent is reliving that trauma. So they are particularly susceptible to sort of the brainwashing, because in their memory, what they're holding on to is, I don't want to go back to the 90s.
Interesting.
So that's just kind of an important, I think, thing to understand. Even to understand Putin has gone rogue. He has definitely gone rogue in actual military operations. But I also think it's important to understand Putin in the duration, in the 20 plus years that he has been in power with whatever. He rewrote the law to let himself extend his presidency. He had somebody else be president for a few years, but really he was the one, you know, doing things behind the scenes. I don't think cult of personality is that helpful, actually. As in, he's a particular personality. He's kind of insane, and what he's doing is, you know, extraordinarily dumb for the future of Russia and Russian people. But there's also like a point of view in what is he trying to do? Like, is he trying to recreate the Soviet Union? Is he trying to recreate the Russian Empire? Is he really pissed off about something? Like, you know, and I don't tend to share the view that he's trying to recreate the empire. I think that there are many, many ways in which he has felt threatened. And he has felt threatened on behalf of Russia's national security from day one. The difference is when he came to power in 2000, Russia was far too weak after the collapse of the Soviet Union to really be able to negotiate with NATO, with the United States, with the European Union on a similar playing field. And since then, that has changed. And Russia has grown, and Russia, I mean, economically, and Russia has become more stable. And Russia finds itself in a place much different from 20 years ago in order to be able to essentially retaliate when there's some sign of being threatened. And there's a lot of history there to sort of unpack, and a lot of it is controversial. And I don't want to claim that I'm an expert on any of it, but essentially, you know, there's a thing that you can call like buffer states or buffer zones. Like in the case of the United States, for example, like why was the Cuban Missile Crisis such a big deal? Well, it's because you had a foreign presence during the Cold War of your sort of opponent really close to the land of the United States, right? You don't want to have tanks or ships or military equipment close to your border. That's a matter of national security. Well, there's a way of looking at several events, Ukraine not being solely one of them, but several events over the last 20 years where Putin has felt threatened that Russia's national security is being encroached upon by the expansion of NATO eastward and by the increased military presence of NATO closer and closer to the Russian border. Now, you can, you know, or one can kind of understand the seizing of Crimea in that way. One can understand the conflict in Georgia in that way. Like, one can understand several kind of political events. One thing that point of view really excludes is the sovereignty of those nations. Georgia, as much as Ukraine, have a right to decide and to choose who they want to align with and how they want to be governed and how they want to move forward. But I think it's fair to say that Putin, as much as United States and NATO and sort of quote-unquote Western powers, are still operating in a kind of balance of powers, maybe outdated politics, where it is about national security of the quote-unquote big superpowers rather than it is about sovereignty of smaller nations. And I think what's unfortunate to observe is Ukraine, as much as, for example, Armenia, if we look at the recent conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is the region between Armenia and Azerbaijan, you know, these are nations that are kind of suffering the consequence of these superpowers playing out their games, and it's the people of those smaller countries, especially, whose lives, you know, it's sad to say, but like for these global superpowers, they don't matter. And yeah, so I guess that was all kind of a roundabout way of saying Putin has gone rogue in starting the war. Putin He didn't wake up like yesterday. It did, you know, he didn't wake up 2 weeks ago and it just occurred to him that this is a good idea. This has been a kind of long in the making, and it's not just him. It's not just about cult of personality. Russia and Putin did not act in an isolated way. And there's a lot about, you know, about sort of West's engagement that provoked him into it. And yeah, maybe we can stop there. Maybe I'll add one thing to sort of
You're fascinating to listen to, so don't stop. Like I'm learning a lot. You're great. You're wonderful.
Especially to add to a kind of brainwashing of people in Russia.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you have to sort of understand that, like, what was it like for people who were sort of brought up to think of the United States as an enemy in some way? My sort of subjective view on it is they didn't think of United States as an enemy nearly as much as people in the United States thought of Russian as an enemy. But nonetheless, they were raised with a sense of otherness, right? Mm-hmm. These are people other to us in ethics and so on. And what, like, there were so many conspiracy theories in the 90s about how the Cold War really ended and what did the United States really do in order to make the Soviet Union collapse, and, you know, and so on. But one of the ways, I think, for, like, rebuilding a kind of national identity that Putin has taken a stronghold in that is distinct from the U.S. and that, okay, Russia's a part of this sort of globalized world, which is very much Western influence, but Russia's not Western. Russia is different. Part of that is also portraying the United States as in a negative light and calling United States out on its hypocrisy and the United States and the West. But I think, yeah, particularly of interest to United States because that's who the Cold War was really with. And, you know, it's not that hard to do. Like, the U.S., you know, for all the rhetoric of freedom, democracy, and liberty, United States is the biggest military-industrial complex. The United States has started countless wars around the world. You don't have to look very far. Look at, you know, the military regimes that United States instilled in Latin America, which led to millions of people being displaced and killed and to this day disappeared, all sort of done in the rhetoric and under the name of democracy, liberty, and freedom. And so, again, and like, this is maybe going off into a different subject, but if you're Putin and you want to kind of promote our utmost suspicion of when people say democracy, it equals bad. When people say democracy doesn't equal good, there are many historical examples you can pull from very recent history to sort of motivate people, you know, again, people who are not going to think multidimensionally, but people who don't want to go back to the trauma of the 90s and are just going to want to live simple daily lives. There are many easy ways for them, for the media to be presented in a way that makes people want to not be Western, want to be as far away from that as possible. I think it's just an important thing to consider, not only in analyzing Russian media and how did it get to the state that it is now, but also maybe for all your listeners, kind of a self-reflection, you know, like, because I think it's there's something extraordinarily difficult about even going to, like, an anti-war protest on the United States soil, which is a country that has promoted so many wars and has started so many wars, and it is, you know, that protest is being held on stolen land, and again, that's complexity. That's not pointing fingers at somebody and saying, "Well, I can't believe you're going to protest." But that is the kind of complexity, unfortunately, in this day and age, we are all responsible for holding. And this conflict is, you know, not any different.
Yeah, there's so many layers to it. I mean, and there's so many layers to what you said that I'm like, I could go off on so many tangents with all of that, like the United States hypocrisy involving everything, and even in just how, again, we're restricting a lot of imports, exports with Russia at the moment. And I do wonder if they continue fighting until inevitably, you know, they take over Ukraine, whatever. It's like, so then do we just continue cutting Russia off from the world, or then do we follow our classic United States history of being hypocrites and going back and then releasing the sanctions because it's now hurting us and we're only thinking in a self-centered way? Or on the flip side, it's like they stop the war, but then what happens then? Because now the Russian economy is so severely tanked, and I can't imagine in any way anyone's going to want to visit out of like fear for a long time. So it's like, how is there any winning really in this at this point? Even though we're only a couple weeks into it, it's pretty unbelievable. Like when I think about how NATO's reacted, how countries who are typically neutral like Switzerland have reacted, it's been pretty quick thus far, and the damage is done in a way.
Yeah, I think, two things. One is, I am not an economist, but I know, that long-lasting effects of this will also shape the global economy. Like, there's a kind of realignment and a stronger alignment that Russia will have with China moving forward, for example. And I don't know what that will look like. And I don't know if Russia, China, plus, you know, five other nations that are growing or becoming bigger may down the line, I don't know, a few years down the line, have a kind of economic opposition almost as an infrastructure to the current global market and global economy. I don't doubt that there are people actively thinking about it. And you know, as much as Putin has gone rogue, I'm sure there are plans being made that I just cannot conceive of and I don't know about.
Definitely.
But I don't think they will be transparent to anyone in the West. Not at this point, anyway. And also, I guess, like countries like Switzerland, I mean, no country in the world is going to say right now, I endorse the war and the murder of civilians, right?
Yeah.
I think one thing that's been brought up a lot is that, well, where was Switzerland about, for example, the war in Yemen or the war in Syria or the ongoing conflict in Palestine? And one thing that I'm kind of, I don't want to use the word happy, but I'm pleased to see that people are kind of all over the place calling out a certain double standard that, you know, because these are refugees from Ukraine who are white and have blue eyes, somehow it is harder to ignore them. It is harder to ignore the scope of the humanitarian crisis. But one thing that I hope people will continue to point out and talk about is, you know, this is not the first massive refugee crisis since the World War. Like, and we've even seen that, I'm sure you've seen that as well, that, you know, it has been harder for certain people who were in Ukraine to leave Ukraine if they're people of color and if they're not Ukrainian citizens, harder to leave as in to get asylum even at the Polish border.
It was interesting to see that again, like hypocrisy pointed out, or that just like blatant racism in the news of people saying, like, we wouldn't expect it in a place like this. This isn't the Middle East. This is, and I'm like, I don't know, how can you not hear yourself talking right now? Your obvious racism right now and bias. It's interesting how people, and even when you were talking too, I'm like, it was a similar thing with the Black Lives Matter movement. Of people being like, this isn't new. Like this, like everyone has ignored this up until now to a certain extent. It's finally being addressed, but it's hard to look past how silent so many parties were for so many years.
Yeah.
And it does feel like this is yet another one of those moments, especially in the last couple years or decade. It feels like we've had quite a few of them, quite a few breaking points or turning points.
And maybe that's, you know, needed and necessary. Like things need to fall and to collapse. And one of the reasons I kind of went off on that tangent about the United States is I think empires must fall. And that includes all empires. And if the Russian current attempt at recreation of an empire, even though I outlined its maybe motivated by national security more than imperial integrity, but nonetheless, it's an attempt to recreate an empire, that will only have so many ripple effects if other empires also kind of agree that we can do national, international politics, global politics in a different way, where it isn't about imperial superpowers. I was in Chile in 2018 when there were protests happening there, and I remember it was so interesting for me to see how people were like, we cannot live in this normal. There's a sense of normalcy around us, which ignores so much trauma and ignores so much invisible history, and just ignores the reality of an unsustainable life. And I think, this conflict is that too. Like, there needs to be a different normal. And what is that normal going to be for Russian people? I don't know. But the normal that they were living for a while now was no longer sustainable because, I gave you, like, with the media, some more recent things. But, even like pre-pandemic, I had colleagues and friends who were being fired from teaching positions at universities because they said something that was deemed inappropriate against Putin or about against a new decree or something like that, and like that couldn't be sustainable like that, and it does need to fall. And how is it going to be rebuilt, and how are the Russian people going to survive it? I like no one has answers, but the answers are the same as for the Black Lives Matter movement. It's, through organizing and through solidarity, and that solidarity has to come from the international community, and there will be risks involved. But the Russian people from within Russia will only be able to do so much on their own. And so the first and foremost thing, and maybe the most important thing that people can do, is not other Russian people and understand that they need collaboration and they need support, and they are in danger, and they don't know what to do, and they have no, prices are going to rise, salaries are going to drop, their freedom of travel is going to be exceptionally limited, their freedom of self-expression is exceptionally limited. The last thing they need right now is the international community, calling them names and kind of turning their backs to them.
I completely agree. And that's what I was trying to think about too, because it is easy to other people in scenarios like this of like clearly you feel a lot of empathy for people in Ukraine. And when I was talking to someone in Ukraine, it was easy to see her perspective as well, because it was being aggressed upon, especially
Of
in
course.
their case where she was describing her country within the last decade that it was in a bit of a renaissance. So to have that period interrupted as well, I'm sure you just it feels like you're, for an analogy that works for me very well, it feels like you're on mile 25 of 26 of a marathon, and then you have to drop out, and you're like, we were so close, this is so not fair, this is so not right, this is devastating. So what do you think, aside from all of that too, that people can do to help? Because I know that people want to help, and I know that a lot of it is feel a lot of people feel helpless, and a lot of the acts that people are trying to do really feel like they aren't actually going to do anything. Do you think there's anything that people just can do in a time like this, really?
Yes, there's always something you can do. Organizing is always available. I do think, in the same way that grassroots organizing is the most important for local issues, getting involved with, for example, in Ukraine, there are all sorts of donations and funds being established. But I also know there are, like drivers. There are people who have stayed and not evacuated for reasons that they understand, that so many train stations have been bombed that people need transportation. And so there are people who are volunteering their time and risking their lives just to transport people. All of those people have a bank account, and all of those people, need, they don't have time or energy to wait for humanitarian support. Like, they need help now. And if you speak Russian or Ukrainian, it's very easy to get involved. On Telegram, there's so many channels. Like, for example, on Telegram, there's a channel for almost every city in Ukraine right now. That like
Wow.
evacuation Kharkov, evacuation Kiev, and there will be thousands of messages per day of people being like, you know, I am a family of three. Please, can somebody drive me from my hometown to the next? You know, and then some people are offering, and of course they're always scams. And of course you also have to think beyond, you know. You cross the Ukrainian border and men are not allowed to leave right now. It's only women and children.
Yeah.
That creates a recipe for disaster because that's a recipe for human trafficking. So,
Yeah.
you know, there are also efforts, local efforts, Facebook groups, very simple. Like there's a Facebook group for Polish volunteers and for Romanian volunteers and for Moldovan volunteers of people greeting these refugees at the border. You know, how can you help there logistically? Can you, if you speak Russian or Ukrainian, can you be in one of these chats just updating people, like what's going on and, you know, where can they go? So, and I'm talking about the Ukrainian situation, but I think in the Russian situation, it's not too different. It's talking to people. It's just talking to people. And a lot of people in Russia speak English. A lot of people, you know, again, there's a wide array of opinions and there's some people who, you know, want to believe that the images of Kharkov being bombed is staged and not real. And maybe you can't do anything for these people at this point. Maybe that's okay. But there are many other people in Russia with whom you can just have conversations, you know. You know, this is a really difficult thing to prioritize now because I do think the most immediate support needs to go to Ukrainian people. But I think down the line, as people try to leave Russia or try to live in Russia, especially people who have, you know, been at protests and are endangered, they will need financial support because they can't get jobs in Russia. And, you know, when they leave Russia, it's not clear that they can get a status anywhere. And those people will too need support for having their story shared and for having their voice being heard. I do want to stress that it's not a humanitarian crisis in the same way that is in Ukraine, but it will continue to unfold and it will be durational. And those conversations need to be maintained just as much.
Yeah, and there's, of course, it's easy to say, like, put all of your support in one side of it, but you're correct in saying, like, you also do need to think about the long-term, greater picture of things. And just, you know, it's 200 million people and there's over 7 billion people on the planet. We have more than enough other people to help this other group of people. It's not like there isn't enough to go around in some way. There isn't scarcity in that sense. I saw such a, to your point about other ways to help, I saw such a heartwarming video too of a man who was just greeting refugees, I think entering Poland. He was playing the piano and he was just playing the piano because everyone, of course, was entering so stressed out that he was like, the way I can help is that I enjoy playing the piano. I'll bring my piano. It makes me want to cry just talking about it, of like, I will do what I can in this moment. And it was so touching. I'm gonna cry. Look at me. It's happening. Because it was such a, I think you can feel so helpless in these situations, but there is always something you can do. If you can't house someone, if you're not in one of the neighboring countries where refugees are entering, you know, there is always something that you can do. And I think it is important to remember that if you want to help, there is a way. You are not helpless. Everyone is capable of helping.
Yeah. And, you know, quite practically, again, thinking down the line for Russian as well as Ukrainian people, you know, Ukrainian people will have refugee status for the first few months. And depending on the country, they'll have some aid from the government, but they will need jobs. And they will need a way to live. And humanitarian aid at some point will dry out. And some people will consider going to other countries where they can have work and where they can have a legal status and where they can get a visa, where their kids can go to school. And so I really think it's kind of anywhere you are in the world. You can organize and push your local government to push for those opportunities. You know, for example, to come to the United States, it's not trivial to get a visa. It's really hard as a Russian citizen, but it's not trivial even as a Ukrainian citizen, you know. And so, like, sometimes there will be institutions that put out opportunities, but who's going to help them get that visa? Who's going to help them, you know, with pro bono lawyers and all of that? And, you know, it can be a case of just oh, you know one person who needs support. And in trying to help that one person, you'd be surprised how big of a network you build by just asking people, asking, you know, a law firm, would they be willing to do pro bono work? Asking, you know, this institution, would they be able to create a 2-year contract? And you know, and then if you're overwhelmed, get a buddy to do it with you. That's already organizing. You have a team of two, you know. And so those kinds of acts, like you help one person out and then you're like, wow, I have a whole network. I could help another person out, you know. And it's no small feat. Like, you know, even if one individual, as a result of this crisis, of this displacement, of losing their home, of losing their homeland, of, you know, like if at least one person is then guaranteed safety, security, and the ability to continue to live as a human being, like, you, good job. You know, like, high five, you did something splendid.
And stop being an overachiever, stop wanting more. It's giving yourself a break and doing what you can versus trying to do everything all the time.
And one other thing, this is just sort of thinking about maybe an important thing for people to know as well, is the proximity of Russia and Ukraine. Like, I think of all the Russian people I know living in Russia or living outside of Russia, such a high percentage of them have family in Ukraine. Like, it is not historically... They are different cultures, they are different languages, but they do have origins in the Slavic world that are very entwined and very close. There are a lot of shared songs, there are a lot of shared traditions, there's a lot of shared food, there's a lot of shared family lineages. And like my grandparents were from Ukraine, and I've been to that city and I've spent a lot of time in Ukraine as a child, and like, that's not just me, that speaks to so many Russian people. And so it's also, you know, just to understand that, like, Russians not supporting the war is just logical, because those are their brothers and sisters. Like, what, you know, any kind of conflict where you have to point a gun at your kin, at members of your kinship, is just, you know, it's horrific. And nothing about this conflict was so provoking to the normal people that they would actually endorse and want to do that. And so, you know, I know a lot of Russian people who are also helping in Ukrainian evacuation efforts, because that's really the most they can do right now. It's just to sort of kind of, it's to add another 2 cents to the non-binarism of the whole situation. It's not productive. It's not historically accurate, nor is it productive to paint Russians and Ukrainians in the sense of otherness. That's not right. And, you know, we have other precedents of that in global conflict. We have India and Pakistan. We have, like, you know, there are other precedents of borders being drawn at some point in time by some power who thinks that's a sensible thing, and then that border leads to dispute and to warfare. But, you know, that's not how humanity developed. Humanity developed fluidly. There's a settlement here. They spoke a language. They started traveling over, you know, hundreds of years. It evolved, it developed, but there's continuity of culture. And so borders, like nation state borders, are just a horrific invention of the global superpowers, which is another reason empires must die.
Well, on that note, I really do thank you for sharing some history and some perspective, some knowledge, with so much care and grace in every word that you delivered. So thank you. And I really appreciate you talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for all the questions. And I'm curious how your audience will receive it.
I think they'll really enjoy it. And that's it. Wow. I'm blown away at that conversation, at her perspective, at her knowledge, at her way of unpacking such a complicated situation with just such intelligence and such grace. Like, it was even, I guess, not easy, but I was able to understand it and to comprehend all of it. And I am not an expert on history or geography. So thank you, Nastya, for bringing light to this for me. I hope everyone deeply enjoyed it. If you did, definitely click the thumbs up. Leave a comment down below. Tell me something that you learned. Share this with a friend. I think everyone needs to hear this and realize that this situation is not like super binary. There are a lot of people being affected, and I just want, you know, I want it to stop, but also I just want everyone to realize that and to see who the real enemy is, I guess, if that makes sense. But anyways, again, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. I hope you have a peaceful week. I hope you are well, safe, happy. I hope you get a good night's rest. Drink a chilled glass of H2O, and I will see you, or you will hear me, super, super soon. Okay. Bye.